This episode of This Week on Broadway is sponsored by SeatGeek. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, add a promo code, and enter the promo code BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk with Jose Lana. Our reviews include The Marvelous Wonderettes at the Kirk Theater on 42nd Street, Nathan the Wise at Classic Stage Company, Ideation at 59 East 59, and in the television and film realm, we talk about The Greatest Showman on Earth is coming up, NT Live Encore series for 2016, and all the way on HBO. Please stay tuned. They'd kill us, everyone. I promised to my mother, she meant so much to me, that for every single tear she shed, there'd be a victory. That for every single tear she shed, there'd be a victory. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, April 17th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critterland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Damn good.
Good. Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and other places. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. And Matt and I have been doing that thing called Today on Broadway, so you might have heard that as well. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Jose Lana is joining us by phone. Broadway fans know Jose from the 1996-98 revival of The King and I, also in Rent, Street Corner Symphony, Flower Drum Song, 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, Wonderland, and back at the current revival of The King and I. Jose, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, good morning. So tell us, the first thing that we should talk about right away is you've been fortunate enough to get cast in two different revivals of The King and I on Broadway. And Peter was just mentioning before, did you do King and I at a paper mill as well?
I did not. I did not. I was not part of that production. The King and I has been very nicely bookended at the beginning now and at the current part of my career. So it's never been touched in between.
So. Okay. So what's your, you know, you did Lunta back in 96 to 98, and now you are the king of Siam. So tell us how the progression is.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's been very, very profound, actually, not to make it too, you know, serious, but, you know, when I auditioned for The King and I in 95, I was a freshman in college, and it was not anything I expected to get. It was literally a dream come true. You know, like everybody who comes to New York with Broadway dreams. It was the right show at the right time. And, I was very naive and very young. And, that show for me, that 96 production, especially with Lou Diamond Phillips and Donna Murphy being such great, friends and mentors to a young 19-year-old, it was my first family and my first kind of experience as a professional actor. And the 15 months I spent in that first production were some of the best months of my life. And so, and I'm still friends with all of those people. We just had our 20th anniversary party a couple months ago. And there are some people who actually are in the current revival at Lincoln Center who were in that production as well with me 20 years ago. Although all the kids now are in their 30s. Yeah. But so when this production came along, actually, you know, about two years ago when they first started talking about, when they announced Lincoln Center and they announced Kelly and they announced Ken, I actually had a meeting with Bart to possibly play Lunta again. And it was, and clearly at that meeting, I mean, I took the meeting and we had a nice long talk, and I think Ted Sperling was there too. I realized that I wasn't him anymore, you know, and as much as I could still, you know, I mean, if I had to, like, you know, sing the songs and stuff, but the Lunta that I played 20 years ago was exactly where I was in my life. I guess, well, casting the part then. And I just wasn't him anymore. And I think if they had tried to cast me in as that part, it would not have worked as well.
I want to point out that you're probably emotionally at a different point in your life, but, you know, I've seen you in it back in 20 years ago and today, and I'm pretty sure you have some sort of Dorian Gray picture in the attic because you look exactly the same.
You do, in fact. All right, so the question becomes, here you are. You have this new album that's just come out, and yet you do have two songs from King and I, and they're not the King songs. So this was a nice trip back in time and nostalgia. The songs? And you like the songs, obviously, to put them on the album.
Right. You know, the album itself was, the inspiration for the album was the concert I gave at Lincoln Center for the Songbook Series last year. That's what started this whole album, actually. So, I was asked to do the Songbook Series last year, and when I got together with my musical director, Tim Grigsby, the concert formed into basically a recap of my career, and to do that, I needed to include, obviously, the beginning of it, which was We Kiss in a Shadow and I Have Dreams. So the evening turned into very much a very autobiographical trip down memory lane of all the shows that I've done, and the evening was very successful, and it was a lot of fun. And actually, coincidentally, the March 15th concert for the Songbook Series was exactly the first preview of the King and I across the street at Lincoln Center. And little did I know that 6 months later I'd be stepping in for the King. So while this whole past year has been about me going into the King and I and out, and then the album was being recorded during the year, and so the whole album basically has become very much a time capsule of like the first 20 years of my career, ending with the King and I again. So it's really been a really fun and energetic kind of walk through memory lane.
Okay, Altitude is the name of it. That means
Altitude is in reference to one of the Adam Gettle pieces from Saturn Returns. It's from Icarus, and it's from the show we did at the Public in 1998 called Santa Returns. And I wanted to pick a word that kind of symbolized kind of the upward flight and risk and youthful energy that kind of represented the first part of my career.
I noticed the initials M, U, and E after Chip's Lament. Now we know what that means. You know? You don't want to give away the joke, do you?
That's exactly right. When we were putting together the show, it was very much like Dance 10 Looks 3. You know, you didn't want the audience to look at the song list and go, "Oh, there's an erection song." Mm-hmm. So, because you want that first laugh when he says the word for the first time.
Sure, sure.
And so, so that's why it's forever. The title of the song is Forever Chip's Lament, and with parentheses M U E. So it's my version of Dance 10 Looks 3. So
now, since you spent 15 months in the King and I way back when. How influenced are you by Lou Diamond Phillips' performance? Is there any of it in yours? Are there any tips you took from him? Did you say, I'm doing it completely differently?
You know, I think an answer to all those questions is a little bit of yes in all of them. You know, I think because Lou was my first King, and we're closer in age to each other than most of the other Kings that have played the part, because he was a very young King as well, and I'm a younger King. Mm-hmm. Especially, compared to some of the other Kings. Like, I mean, people associate with Leo Brenner because he aged in the part 30 years while he played it. Mm-hmm. And Ken's a little older than me as well, and Hoon's a little older than me. So, like, my King will always be a little bit on the youthful side, just by naturally, who might be, to the extent that I am, a little younger. But I think what Bart and I tried to do, and hopefully was successful, is that I formed my own take on it. And Bart's approach to the show was very different from Chris Renshaw's approach 20 years ago, our director for the 96 revival. So much more Bart's is much more political. It's grounded in much more of like the era of the time and the political pull that the King had and kind of the gravity of that. So, but you know, Lou came to the show last year and Donna came twice, actually, which is such a reflection of how close that 96 family was.
Oh, that is nice. Yeah.
So, but Lou could not have been more proud. It was like my older brother was coming to cheer me on and yeah. I was putting on his shoes. So sure. It was
so
really great.
Back in 96, you were 19. Where were you going to school at the time?
Manhattan School of Music.
You were
a conservative.
Yeah.
Voice major.
So you were at Manhattan School of Music and you were casting this production. You were 19. Are you from the area? Did you move to the area to go to Manhattan School of Music?
I moved here from Northern Virginia. I grew up in Northern Virginia, right outside of D.C., but I was born in the Philippines.
Okay. So you were kind of new to New York. Is that fair to say?
Very new. I was a freshman in college and doing all the things a freshman in college does. And it was an extremely fun and terrifying year. I think that whole first year, I'm shocked at just how bold I was. I was supposed to go to engineering school. I turned down a scholarship to Cooper Union, which is where my sister was at the time, for engineering. And my sister did everything they were supposed to do. She went to Cooper Union, MIT, and now she's a successful engineer. And I told my parents I wanted to go to music school. And they gave me 2 years. And if nothing happened in 2 years, then I had to go back to engineering school. And something happened. So I knew my clock was ticking. And so when I got to New York, I started auditioning. I got headshots, and I just started going to open calls. And then luck would have it, my freshman year in college, they were auditioning for a Broadway revival of The King and I, which was the perfect show for the perfect time for me. So I'm very lucky about that.
What was it like to make that phone call when you're 19 years old and calling your parents to say you just booked a Broadway show?
You know, it was completely surreal. I think that at first they didn't believe me. Luckily for me, it didn't come overnight. That production, yeah. Because I was so young, they kind of kept me going for. They kept calling me back at least a dozen times, and I didn't know any better because I wasn't an equity member, so I didn't. I thought, oh, everyone gets called back 7 or 8 times or 9 times, and they kept having me sing with different girls, and most of the girls thought I was the reader, so they just, you know, read with me, and there even came a point where halfway through the process, Jay Binder called me into his office and said, okay, well, so this is our first round in New York. You have a job, whether that's in the ensemble, the understudy, or the part is not determined yet. We're going to leave New York for the summer and audition in Hong Kong and London and other places. And we're going to come back, at the end of the summer. And in the meanwhile, we're going to send you to Joan later we want her opinion of your voice.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what happened. The newly minted Tony winner, Joan later has been my mentor for the past 20 years. They paid for me to go, take lessons with her, for the summer. And at the end of the summer, she gave them the verdict that she thought I could do it, and that's how I got the job.
So Joan, Donna Murphy, Lou Diamond Phillips, you're 19, you're in New York. This is kind of a new version of 42nd Street. So tell me, Lou Diamond Phillips had a famous poker game during King and I. Did you have a chance to play in it?
I didn't. You know, I think I somehow missed the poker game. You know, I was busy trying to get into bars. You know what I mean? I mean,
first it's things first. Thing,
when you're a thing, like, I was technically the oldest child in the cast. I mean, I was closer in age to the princes and princesses than I was to half the cast. And, you know, when the cast would hang out, I would be like, can I come? And they're like, oh, you might get carded. I'm like, oh, great. Never mind. You know, so it's, that first year I was very much everyone's little brother in the company. And it's funny because we had a 10-year anniversary, we had a 15, and we had a 20-year this past year. And you know, when you go back home to your family for the holidays, you instantly revert to like your role in the family. And every time Lou's in the room or Don is in the room, I instantly become like, I'm like the pimply 19-year-old. It's like, can I come along? Thanks. What's that? Oh, what's that restaurant? Great. You know, it's like, that was like my energy when I was 19 and living in New York for the first time. So
tell me about, you ended up at Manhattan School of Music. So were your parents artistic? Were they musical? Were they into theater? How did you end up there?
Well, you know, my parents were the typical, they gave up everything to immigrate to the U.S. We left because of the Marcos regime. And my mom is not musical, but my dad played the guitar in a band in Manila, and just for fun. And then every Saturday and Sunday morning in our house here in New York and in Virginia, he would play the guitar and sing Beatles music, Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel. And so I grew up singing harmonies with my dad on the guitar. And so I always sang. And then I joined choir in high school because of my sister. And then lucky enough, in Virginia, we had all the touring companies go through the Kennedy Center and the National Theater.
Uh-huh.
And the first show I saw was Raggedy Ann and Andy the Musical at Kennedy Center when I was, I think, 8 or 9. And then Cats came through, and then Les Mis came through. And I think Les Mis, like most people my age, it blew my mind. And I knew every word of that cast album. Secret Garden was another big show during my high school years. I got to theater a bit. The theater bug bit me when I was in high school, going up to Virginia, and somehow I just decided to go into the theater. And my parents were beautifully supportive, to a point.
So
yeah, there was always a deadline. They said, you know, we're gonna because music school is expensive, you're gonna have to pay for half of it, and we'll give you a deadline. If nothing happens in the first 2 years, you're going back to engineering school. So that was my deadline.
So when you went to them and said, you're going to be playing Angel in Rent, how was that received?
Well, they were happy because it was a Broadway show. I'd been out for a long time at that point. That came out my senior year in high school. So they didn't have any problem with a gay character or drag queen or anything. The only disconcerting thing is that I think in drag, I look like my mom in college.
You really can't hear that anywhere else.
I mean, and my parent, when I played it, when I played Angel in 1998, 1999, my parents had been divorced for already maybe about 20 years at that point. So when my dad came and saw the show, I knew, and I had the exact same haircut as my mom in college. Like she had this bob. And I looked like a very masculine, tall version of my mother from 1969. So that was, I think, the only disconcerting thing for my dad is that he was watching his son, who looked like his ex-wife, on stage in a big dress. So.
Well, James asked what your parents thought when you were cast as Angel. So fast forward, you know, 15, 20 years or whatever, you said your family immigrated because of the Marcos regime, and then you go in and play Ferdinand Marcos in Here Lies Love. How was that, not only for your parents, maybe, you know, personally, but for you to play this character that is such a big part of your culture and your family's history?
You know, it was completely, at first, very intimidating. You know, when I first heard about Here Lies Love, someone told me that the public theater, the first thing I heard was the public theater is workshopping a new musical by David Byrne about Imelda Marcos. And that piqued my interest. And then they were like, Alex Timbers is directing and they're doing a workshop at the public. And the first thing I thought, I went and looked for the breakdown, and it had three major characters. It had Imelda, it had Marcos, and it had Aquino, right? And the activist in me that my parents raised I was like, I'm gonna get my agent to call them and say, I'm your Aquino. Like, I wanted to play the freedom fighter and the future, martyr of the Philippines. And I came in and I sang for them. And the next day I get the offer for Marcos. And I was so heartbroken. I said, no. And I didn't know anything about what the show was going to be about. And I was worried, just like my parents were, that it was going to be a show that maybe celebrated her, celebrated mm-hmm. them. And my parents were apprehensive at first, and when I finally got the material and I saw what they were trying to do, what David was trying to do and Alex was trying to, the story they were trying to tell, it became very important to me. And they were very, and that's why I love the experience for the 4 years on and off that we worked on the piece. They were very sensitive to the Filipino history. They wanted to tell the history. And that meant telling the beginning, middle, and end of the whole regime, like how the country fell in love with them, how they started taking advantage of the trust, and then how they completely robbed the country of all finances and civil rights. So I think it was important. And I think it's become a very important part of who I am now as a Filipino American, that we were able to tell the story. I don't think a lot of people knew much about Filipino history beyond Imelda's shoes,
And yeah.
Because that's the popular soundbite, like, oh, shoes, she had a billion shoes, great. But there's a whole story there, and unfortunately, there are a lot of Filipino Americans who aren't telling the story out of shame, out of regret that it ever happened. Mm. So there are a bunch of Filipino Americans my age and younger who know nothing about it. Mm. And so now those mistakes are being repeated in Filipino government right now. And there's a whole generation of Filipino Americans who don't know anything about what happened during the Marcos regime. And it's important to tell the story. So it's been a really important part of my family history that we were able to tell the story in such a really fun way that was a popular show. So great.
So you have your spring is all kind of laid out for you right now. You're going back into King and I. We have the release of Altitude on Yellow Sound Label. And you have Joe's Pub coming up on Monday, May 16th. What can we look forward to at Joe's Pub?
Joe's Pub, we're going to do the album. We're going to kind of do the album from start to finish. It'll be a nice little journey. We've added three more songs from the songbook concert last year. We're going to do my version of Puzzlement, which is obviously the new song in my life. We're going to add a Sondheim piece in there, Marry Me a Little, and also an original piece from a new musical by Anne Marie Malazzo from a show called Pretty Dead Girl that we workshopped a couple of years ago. So it's going to be a fun night. I'm really excited.
That's great, and that's on your Monday night.
Exactly.
Which will be right in the middle of the craziness of what happens in the New York theater scene in the spring. So that'll be a lot of fun as well. Is Grigsby your musical director on Monday night as well?
Yes, Kim Grigsby will be back. And I've got the entire band gathered that we did for the album and also for the songbook concert for last year. We formed this little band. It's kind of great. And they were all available, and some made themselves available for it. So it's nice when you can have a unit together and hopefully recreate that sound that was so successful the first time around.
So the official release of the album is on Friday, May 13th, and then Monday, May 16th at Joe's Pub. And you have King and I coming up as well. So
busy time.
Excuse me?
Busy time.
Busy time. So I appreciate you getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us, because you have your busy time, and I hope you get out and enjoy this weather. It's a beautiful Sunday here in New York.
Great.
So you can find Jose on Twitter at TheJoseLana, and also at joselana.com, and we'll have links to that stuff in the show notes. Jose, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us. It's really wonderful to catch up with you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
This week's episode is sponsored by SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell tickets for theater, sports, and music. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on all the sites in one place so you can save time and you never miss a deal. Best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket sites, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Broadway Radio listeners can get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab and click Add a Promo Code. Enter our code, which is BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. If you are a fan of Broadway Radio, I hope that you will support SeatGeek. Download the app and give it a try. Okay, so Peter, you got a chance to see The Marvelous Wonderettes, which is Roger Bean's creation. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, this is a revival. So I had been, about 10 years ago to see it at the West Side. So I knew it was coming. Anyway, at intermission, the couple next to me slowly got up, doleful looks on their faces, grabbing for their coats, their backpacks, all this kind of stuff, and I knew they were leaving. And I wanted to say, no, don't go, because this is a very clever show. It's just that you may not realize it at the beginning. All right, so here we have four young women. It's 1958, and they're singing songs at their senior prom. So they're singing Mr. Sandman and songs of that vintage. All the songs deal with, can I find a man to love me? Won't that be wonderful? I hope the man of my dreams comes along. All that, a lot of dreaming imagery, in fact. In fact, that line in All I Have to Do is Dream, I'm dreaming my life away. So this is what it's all about at the beginning. And you think to yourself, all right, I get it. Forever Plaid was such a big hit. Somebody said, hey, let's do it with women too. And won't that be terrific? So it does have that sense of we've been there already. And these people aren't as smart as Stuart Ross was because he got there first with Forever Plaid. However. What happens is the second act takes place in 1968, 10 years later, and these women are older and wiser and sadder and wiser, too, needless to say. But what's so interesting is the fact that you find out how much music changed in 10 years as well, because suddenly these women are singing songs like You Don't Own Me. And so, therefore, you really see not only the development of what happened in music, but how it influenced these women as well, because that's what happened. Art influences, and art gives permission. So as a result, seeing women having heard You Don't Own Me, they now come to believe You Don't Own Me, where in the first act, they were ready to be owned lock, stock, and barrel. So it's really quite a clever show. There is a bit of book to it, too. I mean, because in the first act, two women are fighting over the same man. In the second act, we find out that one has won him. But what has she won? He didn't turn out to be so splendid. That's what makes The Marvelous Wonderettes interesting. It does have a point of view. So even though it doesn't seem it in Act 1, I dare say, if you go, please stay for Act 2. You'll be very impressed at what happens there.
Peter, the cast for this is a pretty interesting cast with Jenna Lee Green and Kathy Breyer and Christina Bianco and Sally Schwab. How were they in their, you know, kind of telling this story from one decade to the next?
Terrific indeed. They had the innocence and the naivete in the first act, and they had the sadder but wiser life experience in the second. So I thought they were all very successful. At times it seems spoofy, I'll grant you that. Roger Bean also directed as well. But that isn't really the focus. Every now and then there's a little bit over the topism, but not enough that you really say, I don't believe that. It's very possible with women getting back together. And of course, you know, two of the women have stayed friends, two have drifted apart. That's so he really gave this a lot of thought, and it's more substantial than many of the knockoffs. Now, ironically enough, in 1988, there was actually. Anyway, there was a show called The Taffetas And the Taffetas was really that type of thing. It was just girls singing, and no more came of it than that. You know, they're in their enormous gowns, as these girls are in the first act, by the way, almost as big as Mrs. Anna's skirt, you know, with petticoats underneath and all that kind of stuff. The Taffetas simply did the songbook. That's all they did. It was all about, oh, remember these songs way back when. So this was a much smarter way of doing it to show us the growth. And also, by the way, the first act punch bowl. In the second act, these ladies can drink now. And as a result, there isn't just punch over there, you know, with the cute little scooper. No, no, no. there are bottles of champagne and they're swigging from them. At least one of them is, because she's so desperate and unhappy. So it says a lot about our society. Yeah, so there's a lot of subtext in the show, and that's what makes it worth staying for.
So, Peter, this is playing at the Kirk Theater on Theater Row on, you know, the west side. I'm looking here. The published ticket price starts at $92.25. Wow. I think that's kind of steep for that this type of show in that type of theater. How was the house there?
I'd say about three quarters full. I have no idea if they were papering or what, but it was three quarters full. Yeah, that is regrettable that it's so high. I guess it's one of those stories, again, where they make the ticket prices high, so when they discount to $20, you say, wow, what a deal I'm getting. You know. And I think that may be, you know, if people want to pay it, fine. Ironically enough, I also saw the tickets were $119 on StubHub. So, if you're naive enough to pay it, you know, then you pay it. And if you don't know any better, but I think many of our listeners, if not all, are very savvy about how to get into shows for far less money than the ticket price demands.
All right. Next up, you got down to Classic Stage Company to see Nathan the Wise, with quite a cast, F. Murray Abraham. So tell us, what you think of Nathan?
In fact, F. Murray Abraham played Nathan and rather underplayed him. I expected him to be substantially more vigorous in this part. He is playing the father of a daughter who does get involved with a Christian, and he has to deal with that. But there's also a Muslim situation going on there, and a Jewish situation as well. Nathan, of course, is Jewish, and he has to maneuver in the city of Jerusalem way back when. This takes place a long time ago. And it's a very, very hard thing, of course, when you have to deal with two religions, not just one, that feels that you've made the wrong decision in religions, and when are you going to straighten out, and when are you going to learn what to do? So it's a pretty complicated situation, and there's a wonderful moment at the beginning of the second act where F. Murray Abraham does tell a fable involving Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And for that matter, that really is worth hearing. He really comes a bit alive there. But it's definitely a case of underplaying, and I was very surprised to see him underplaying, because I thought there'd be more to it. This play, by the way, is, well, Classic Stage, so you know it's not necessarily a new one. Occasionally they do something new. But this is actually an adaptation of a play that was done way back in the 30s and 40s. It was even on Broadway for a little while, which you don't expect too much from Classic Stage. Sure, I mean, they've done plays that were on Broadway in the sense like Cyrano de Bergerac, let's say, Classics, sure, that's the name of the company. But to find this play that lasted only about a month on Broadway way back when is really something. It's a spruce-up, it's a new adaptation, but still, to think that they actually found this play, a Broadway play, rather than a play that started in Europe or anything like that. This one really started here. So that's interesting for its own sake as well. But I will have to say that Stark Sands is really marvelous as the young man who falls in love with the daughter. And if you think that this sounds all very serious and conflicting, I will tell you that suddenly, at the end of the show, It's a combination of Amy's Irish Rose and A Funny Thing Happened All the Way in the Forum. Suddenly, it gets very silly, and we don't see that coming, and I think a lot of people are going to have a problem with the silliness of it. I have a feeling that this has to do with Brian Kulik's direction, that he wanted us to take this story very seriously at the beginning and then was going to slip in this, there's no other way of putting it, comic ending. So I have a feeling this play looked very different on Broadway way back when, that it was directed as something a little more lighthearted, because since it's all going to a very lighthearted conclusion, I have a feeling that the direction certainly stressed that way back when. But it's an entertaining enough and certainly a show that does give you pause and starts to make you wondering about religion. And yeah, if somebody were born, let's say, a Jew, therefore he has been inculcated to believe that the Jewish religion is what it is. But what if you were, simply were born on the other side of town to another family? That's what you'd believe. And these questions do come up, and they're very good questions as to why we believe what we believe. Is it simply the way we were brought up? Is that all there is to it? Is there more to it than that? And, of course, the idea of which is the real of the three religions, which is a question that can never be answered, but it is posed. So Nathan the Wise is certainly worth taking in to a certain degree, but you're going to feel – the set, by the way, is basically nothing more than a rug, but you're going to feel like the rug has been pulled out from under you at the end of the show.
So one thing to note here is that it seems as though that this is Brian Kulik's last show at Classic Stage Company. Do you know?
Yeah, because John Doyle's coming in. He's taking over as artistic director.
Yeah, Kulik was the sixth artistic director of Classic Stage Company starting in 2003, so he's been there for 13 years. And this is the last show he will direct as the artistic director. Well,
it is marvelous that this place still exists. I had, ironically enough, taken a young woman who was the daughter of the actress who played the leading female role in my play when it was done in Iowa this past December. So as we were walking out, she said, "Gee, what a nice little theater this is." And I said, "You know, it's been here a long time. I believe the first time I ever stepped in here was 1979. Hmm. And that's really great that a Classic Company, all right, yeah, sometimes they don't have to pay royalties when they're putting on a Midsummer Night's Dream. But still, the fact that there is an audience that comes down to Classic Stage, and you and I know that they have had some really high-powered people. I mean, here's F. Murray Abraham, an Oscar winner, and that's not the first one they've had there, and it won't be the last. So this is a place where people like to go and exercise their classic muscles and in theatrical terms, and I think it's really great that such a company has been able to hold on. At least 37 years that I've known about it, and I really don't even know how long they were there before I found out about it. So they've been there.
That is very true. The Classic Stage Company began in 1967.
Wow.
100-seat theater at a Rutgers Presbyterian Church on West 73rd Street. So it's just 1985. 1973, they moved to the present premises on 13th Street. Uh-huh. So they were just getting ready for you, Peter.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, it's a nice place to hang out. There's a bar, and I think it's one of the places that people actually go to sit down and have a drink, even if they're not going to go see the show. Hmm. So, you know, as I always recommend to people, by all means, show up at these places, especially if you're single. You may not be single anymore after you sit down for a few times at this place, a more spacious and newer and more elegant place, The Signature, which really is a good place to meet and greet and perhaps more.
And then, Peter, after your journey onto 13th Street, you headed up to 59 East 59, where you saw Ideation So tell us about that.
Yeah, ideation deals with ideas, and we're in a conference room in a tall office building, and of course, everybody who's in that office is very interested in one-upping the other and showing that he has the better idea, the best idea for that matter, above everybody else. So the client they're working with, they say they're going to have to be very careful not to use the N-word. Okay, so we know what that means, except we don't. It's a very different N than the one we're accustomed to hearing when you hear the N word. And I hate giving so much away, but I'm going to, because I don't think it's possible to really talk about this show without giving away that the N word is the Nazi word. And what they're doing is talking about a new final solution. And the thing is, though, to be fair, what they're doing is trying to find a way to get rid of people who are infecting other people. So that's what it is. It's not just the type of motivation that Hitler had, but it is still pretty impressive to watch how dispassionate they are in discussing what is going on. That is the power of the play, the dispassionate nature of everyone on stage. Nobody seems to stop and say, you know, we're killing people. We're making plans. This is horrible. You know, nobody does that because they have a job to do, and also because they want to succeed in being the person to come up with the best solution to this problem. And so that's what it is. It's about how uncaring we've become. That even to this point, that when there really is a worldwide thing to consider, that it is done in such a matter-of-fact fashion. And of course, there is certainly a lot of jockeying for power, needless to say, and there's also a scene involving someone's complete and total humiliation, though that comes back to bite them. So there's a lot of conflict here, and what goes on, what's put on the blackboard is even worth seeing as well. So Ideation is a 90-minute roller coaster ride in its own way, and to a degree, it reminded me of a movie from years ago called The Wannsee Conference. I don't know if you know this picture. Matt, do you know this picture by any chance?
I don't. I was trying to place it real quick. I don't.
All right. Well, this is actually, as I understand it, I may be wrong about this, but I am told that it's the actual transcript of what happened at the meeting when all the Nazis got together and said, okay, how are we going to get rid of the Jews? What do you think we should do? You know, so we said, well, we could gas them. Well, maybe we should just shoot them. You know, and it's really a very chilling film. If you don't know it, I really recommend watching it. But it is really scary, especially there's one moment where they take a break and they go out and you've watched these monsters talk so dispassionately about killing Jews. And one of them goes out and the switchboard operator looks at the guy, you know, and she's interested in him. He's cute. And little does she know who he really is, you know, what is that he's so unfeeling. And this is the one that she wants to spend the rest of her life with. She'd marry him in 14 seconds if he asked her. So it's a pretty chilling film. And for a while, I was really reminded of it. This one does go in a different direction, has different motivation, but still it's a second cousin to this movie. So I can recommend both Ideation and the Wannsee, WANSEE conference.
Wow. Oh, boy.
way to keep it lively on a Sunday morning there, Peter.
Yeah.
It makes me hesitant to mention that I saw The Father at Manhattan Theater Club on Friday night, which was not quite as scary as that, but it's definitely not a production that is something that's going to make you feel good when you're leaving. I did see The Father on Friday night, but we're going to hold off talking about that until next week when Peter will have seen it. He's going to see it today, and I think Michael's going to see it. I neglected to say also that Michael is traveling to Washington, D.C. this weekend and has seen a few shows, so we'll have a little D.C. report, plus we'll talk about Michael's stuff next week when he gets back. All I can say about The Father, Peter, is bring some sunglasses.
Ah, okay.
And
all
we
right.
will
talk about why next week. That was
all right,
my biggest pet peeve with the father was the need for sunglasses.
So do you think Matt can pull us out of this torpor that we're in here?
Matt, the greatest showman on earth, what do you mean by this?
Well, that is not what I'm requesting that you call me from now on. although
that's your new show, your Twiddle handle?
Twitter handle, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'll stick with my current one. But on Friday, it was announced at CinemaCon, a big convention out in Las Vegas, that 20th Century Fox has confirmed that they are moving forward with a new movie musical called The Greatest Showman on Earth that has kind of been workshopped and rumored for a while now. And it is a go for 2017. The film is going to star Hugh Jackman as P.T. Barnum, and the score was written by Tony nominees Benj Pasek and Justin Paul of Pasek and Paul. Yes, I was going to go with Christmas Story, the musical
Dogfight,
and yeah. Edges, and all that stuff. It's important to note that the show has no connection to the Cy Coleman musical Barnum, but obviously has a lot of the same characters and stuff like that. So it'll be interesting to see Hugh Jackman do an original musical on film, and we've seen him do a couple musicals on stage and did Les Mis on film, but I'm imagining that should be fun. I don't know what the focus of that is, but hopefully it's more fun than Nazis trying to figure out how to kill
people. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. So, the National Theatre over in London is doing their Encore series. This is incredible. I love this. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I talked about it earlier this week on Today on Broadway. It might have been the episode you were out, James, but NT Live is bringing some of its biggest productions back to the U.S. screens starting this summer and going throughout the rest of 2016. It's starting probably very well timed, just about a week after the Tony Awards, with a rebroadcast of One Man, Two Governors starring James Corden. That's obviously the role that he won a Tony for when it transferred to New York. This is the a filming of the original London run that will begin broadcasting in U.S. cinemas across the country on June 21st. Then in July, we'll see Helen Mirren's London version of The Audience, which obviously went on to have great acclaim when it transferred to Broadway. Then continuing that trend of shows that started in London and came to New York, we'll have Ivo Van Hove's A View from the Bridge, which just wrapped up its run on Broadway. This is the Young Vic production that will be in September. Then what's kind of become a little bit of a tradition, I think, is they will be rebroadcasting the Benedict Cumberbatch, Johnny Lee Miller, Frankenstein, directed by Danny Boyle. Yeah, Danny Boyle directed it, where they alternate the roles. I believe the way they are saying it is that their broadcast will begin on the 25th, so you will have an opportunity to see both Cumberbatch as the monster and Miller as the monster and vice versa going back. That'll be obviously right around Halloween, so perfectly timed. Then in November, they will rebroadcast Cumberbatch's Hamlet from the Barbican last year, and then they'll end up the season in December with the final performance of the West End version of War Horse, which obviously also did very well here in the U.S., but the final London production from last year on the West End. So that's a pretty cool season. A lot of really good shows. I've seen a number of these broadcasts before, but I'm definitely going to go back to see the other ones, and I might actually go back and I saw Cumberbatch as the monster, so I might try to go see Johnny Lee Miller as the monster in Frankenstein.
And when you're saying broadcast, they are broadcasting to theaters, they're not broadcasting to television.
Correct. They are broadcast in movie theaters across the country. You can check your – I always go to my local AMC to see them, but they'll have them just on regular their regular movie listings, and they're usually anywhere from $15 to $20, but if you think about it, it's not that much more than a movie ticket, and it's something – that's going to be a lot cheaper than if you'd seen these productions in the theater itself. And they usually have some nice backstage stuff before the actual screening begins, where you see some things from the costume design and maybe some of the tech stuff, some rehearsal footage. So it's a pretty cool thing for a theater fan to be able to sit in a nice movie theater with generally not huge crowds and get to enjoy a really cool production.
Yeah, we will have a link to this NT Live in our show notes so that you can find theaters near you. I looked in Manhattan and the IFC Center and Symphony Space and BAM are the local Manhattan places that you can see this, but certainly we have listeners all around the world, and hopefully you can check it out and see where something is broadcasting near you. We also have some news on All the Way from HBO.
Yeah, just this past week, HBO released the first trailer for the screen adaptation of All the Way, which will again star Bryan Cranston as Lyndon Johnson. The HBO film version will air for the first time. If you know HBO, they rerun everything dozens and dozens of times to get their money out of it. But it'll debut on Saturday, May 21st at 8 p.m. In addition to Cranston, Anthony Mackie will be playing Martin Luther King. Melissa Leo will be Lady Bird Johnson. Bradley Whitford, Stephen Root, Frank Langella, who you just mentioned with the father, will also be in it. So that first trailer is out, and it's pretty powerful. Obviously, the show was very well received both in Boston and in New York. So I have no doubt that this production will be very good as well. So I'm sure, James, you've got the link so they can check that out in the show notes if they want, I'm sure.
Excellent. All right. So let's wrap up for the week. Before we go, Peter, did we have anything to talk about Theater World Awards yet, or is that coming up soon?
Yeah, we know we're going to be at Circle in the Square on May 23rd at 7 o'clock. Yes, I'm getting my, what I hope are good jokes ready to MC. We're giving the John Willis Award to Bernadette Peters, who was very fond of John and even showed up at his memorial service to talk about him. She was very grateful early in her career when he discovered her in George M. And gave her a Theater World Award. For those who don't know these awards, they're given to people who are making an off-Broadway debut, an on-Broadway debut, or a big splash that hadn't happened before. So that's what the awards are, and they've been dispensed since 1945 when Daniel Blum started the Theater World Books and had a little shindig in his apartment. Even as late as 1964, they were basically being held in an apartment, as Alan Alda told me a couple of years ago when he came back to present. He said, wow, it's really grown. It really has. It's very nice. And so we do know that May 23rd, on Monday night, 7 o'clock, and we hope it'll go well.
And aside from the Theater World Awards, where you have to get together with the committee and pick who are the recipients of this year's awards, you also have your involvement in Drama Desk and other organizations, plus all the openings that are happening before the Tony Award deadlines. So you have your hands full.
Well, we had a Drama Desk nominators meeting yesterday, in fact, and you know, it's so wonderful that the seven of us really get along so very, very well. Nobody has yet jumped on the table and said, you damn fools, what's the matter with you? How come you don't see? I mean, we're very, very polite about it all, so it's very nice that...
it's very British of you.
It is, you know, I mean, democracy in action, though. So it's very American of us, too, that we just, if four people agree and three don't, that's the end of it. You know, I mean, nobody's been arguing. And, you know, so that's very nice when people realize that it's simply a majority rule situation. And that's all there is to it. So so we look forward to announcing at the end of the month what the Drama Desk nominations are. For those who don't know the organization, it gives out awards both to Broadway and off-Broadway. So Broadway shows compete with off-Broadway shows, and so there are more shows to consider than indeed the Tonys.
That's my hat's off, because that's a much, much more...
It's a lot of shows to see.
A lot of shows to see, exactly. And for listeners out there, I don't know if you are familiar with Michael Riedel and Susan Haskins' public broadcasting system show, Theater Talk. But Adam Feldman, we love Adam, from Time Out New York, and Imogen Lloyd Webber from Broadway.com, were on talking last week. And it was very funny that Riedel was making fun of people like us, you know, Peter, Michael, me, Imogen and Adam Feldman, because at this point of the year we get theater fatigue, because we have to see so many shows and so many openings in a short period of time, but Theater Talk is a wonderful show, wonderful half hour of a weekly show to catch up on what's going on. And if you watch the one with Adam Feldman and Imogen Lloyd Webber, you can hear Imogen tell Riedel to shut up, which is very, very funny. All right. So before we get to trivia, I'd like to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. Contact information for Peter, for Matt, for me, and for Michael can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Also, Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. So, Peter, why don't you give us an answer to last week's trivia?
Well, I don't know that I'm going to.
We had a lot of responses to that, didn't we?
Yeah. The question was, why are these Sondheim songs in this order? There's a private joke here, and the songs were Send in the Clowns, Happily, which is from A Little Night Music, Happily Ever After, which was dropped from Company, Everybody Ought to Have a Maid from A Funny Thing Happened, I Know Things Now from Into the Woods, Losing My Mind from Follies, and Anyone Can Whistle from Anyone Can Whistle. Now, I purposely chose songs that really didn't seem to go with each other, and that's why I threw Happily Ever After in, because it was a drop song. But anyway, Matthew Sklar, the wonderful composer who has got a dance coming to town, was the first to get the answer. Jake Leonard, John Delphin, Jack Lechner, the very talented lyricist of The Kid, Phil Bond, and Jed Slaughter all got it. But you know, I have a feeling I'm going to ruin a property if I give the answer. So what I'm going to say is, if you really want to know the answer, do email me and I'll tell you. But I may very well spoil a property. I will spoil a property for you if I give you the answer. So in a way, I'm sorry I asked the question. But I am very, very impressed that so many people figured out what was going on among those songs. So email me privately.
All right.
All right.
What about the new question?
In the 70s, a musical was trying out in New England. It had a six-word title. Five of the words were actually the name of a song in the show. By the time the show reached Broadway, it had retained only one of the words as its title. The funny thing is that the five words that were dropped were also the name of a song in the show that stayed in the show. The one-word title that was retained was not a song in the show. You'd think they keep the five words to have a title song, but no, they didn't. So the question becomes, what was the original name of the show that included the song title and the eventual name of the show?
All right. So if you know the answer to that question, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Matt Tamanini, Peter Felicia, and Michael Portantier, who will return next week, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
I have dreamed that your arms are lovely. I have dreamed what a joy you'll be. I have dreamed every word you'll whisper when you're close, close to me. How you look in the glow of evening. I have dreamed and enjoyed the so that by now I think I know what it's like to be loved.